things are becoming more chaotic. I mean, what does this portend? I mean, beyond the fear that most people have, the unthinkable, which would be a war between, a nuclear war between, you know, the United States and Russia.
A couple things again, and, you know, it's, even with progressive education or progressively oriented educational efforts, you know, we sometimes miss very big pictures. And I'm talking about myself. And then belatedly something strikes us and I say, how could I have gone through 50 or 60 years of my life not seeing this? There was a guest editorial in the London Times maybe 5 years ago, and it was co-authored by George Robertson, who was a former Secretary General of NATO. He was Lord of Port Ellen. And Patty Ashdown, who had been the European Union's viceroy, if you will, in Bosnia, and was slated to reprise that role in Afghanistan, by the way, on behalf of the European Union, before, you know, a scandal effectively, you know, excluded them from doing that. And they co-authored an article in the London Times where they said, for the first time in 200 years, Western nations are facing a world they don't control. Well, I think they were being too modest. For the first time, 500 years. You know, from the era of exploration and colonization and so forth, for half a millennium, the major Western powers have dominated the world. And now they're looking at the world with the emergence of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, with the so-called BRICS powers, with particularly, I would argue, the Bolivarian Alliance for the Peoples of Our Americas, you know, with in Latin America and the Caribbean, with CELAC. You know, the community of Latin American and Caribbean states, you know, which has every country in the Western Hemisphere except Canada and the United States as a member. You know, you're seeing the peaceful alternative to military blocs starting to emerge, but you're getting also at the same time a Western elite that says, this world's ours. We may only be 8% of it, but we are the civilized world. We are the democratic community. We have to keep in mind that when you look at, you know, for example, Africa now is the second most populous country in continent rather in the world. It's over a billion people, second only to Asia. The founding members of NATO, the 12 of them, seven of them were and remain constitutional monarchies, democratic countries of the world, remain. NATO countries are every single colonial power in Africa. Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Turkey, right? Every single one. These are people who just, you know, assume that they have the right to govern the world. I don't even think it's conscious or deliberate at times. I think this is so ingrained with them that they are willing to let the world perish rather than, you know, loosen the reins of their control on it. And I think that's one of the things we're confronting. This is a very major watershed in human history, the period we're living in, of course.
I remember from about 20 years ago, or maybe a little more, during one of the, and I'm sorry, I don't know which one, during one of the NATO bombings of former Yugoslavia, that there was a comment by the American head of that particular war. He was quite irate that the Europeans hadn't spent the money on their air forces that allowed them to be able to bomb at night and in bad weather. And of course, I made the assumption that that was because they were spending money on frivolous things like healthcare and education. And I wonder if you can comment on, you know, is that still the case?
That's a good question. The actual NATO stipulation or demand is that each member country and aspiring member, right, every candidate member, spend at least 2% of its gross domestic product on the military. And most European countries, in fact, are delinquent. You know, they're U.S. And it's a common topic for U.S. political officials and NATO secretary generals to berate those countries that are not. Surprisingly, sometimes you'll find out a country that is includes Greece, which, you know, as though they could afford to do it at this point. So that this is, you know, part and parcel of it. People, I think, misunderstand the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, both at its foundation in 1949. You know, Edward Herman, amongst others, has made this point very clear, and William Blum is another, that the purpose was not military. There was no Russian military threat to pour across the plains of Hungary or something. That's stuff and nonsense. You know, much less to come to the United States. The purpose was to politically corral countries where there were strong left-wing movements coming out of the resistance in World War II against the fascists. And those were particularly Greece, Italy, Belgium, and France. And what NATO was meant to do is, under the guise of national security and military integration with the United States, to make sure that left-wing parties, communists in the first instance, never enter the government, even in a coalition. You know, the so-called historic compromise in Italy in the 70s, which would have been the tamest thing the U.S. could have ever, you know, you had Kissinger and company, you know, threatening war effectively over that. So, you know, NATO has that has an effect on every, not only in terms of the structuring of the defense industry through so-called interoperability, it has, you know, political checks. If you see, if people have noticed recently, the Poroshenko regime in Kiev is talking about a new lustration law. We haven't heard this term since the Roman Empire, by the way, the Roman Republic. Lustration is to go through former officials and weed out any who had loyalties to a previous regime. It's been tried recently in countries like Bulgaria and Romania. To effect, the only analogy I could draw is perhaps Reconstruction in the South after the Civil War. Yeah, or denazification, but yeah, that's not a bad example. But this is what, you know, that's a good one. What, you know, NATO is now doing. If you're a political opponent of any, in any way, or you supported any government we turned on and overthrew, you are blackmailed for life. Lustration? Like cleaning, L-U-S-T-R-A-T-I-O-N.
Yeah. Is Russia aware of the economic warfare against it, and are they helpless in the ultimate sense?
Okay, I'll answer that. I'm going to be a little anecdotal, but I think it makes the point strongly. In March of 2009, Russia took the initiative of launching Russia Today, the TV station, RT now. And it became very quickly the most watched program in the world. I mean, it outstripped Fox TV and CNN and all that. I don't know why, but somehow my name was given to somebody right at the beginning, and I did a show in March of 2009. And it was right after Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Obama were talking, if you recall, about the reset with Russia. You know, relations had soured during the Bush administration, and now we're going to put them back on a solid basis. And they invited me on the program, and there was some guy with a British accent working for them, you know, who just acted like a real SOB. I mean, he was contradicting me and gainsaying everything, and don't you see it's a reset? But, you know, whoever in the background was doing the graphics did a real great job because they showed, you know, the Russian or the U.S. Missiles being placed in Eastern Europe and everything. But the opening clip is Hillary Clinton getting off the plane in Kiev at the airport and embracing Yanukovych, right? She's coming in to wean Ukraine away. Is Russia aware? They certainly should have been. Are they helpless?
It's a chess game. Are they destined to lose?
It doesn't look good from their perspective right now, but my argument would be that the tone of that person in Russia Today suggested they were willing to deny the inevitable, fool themselves, and attempt to fool other people. And then the results of it is what you see right now, with the Russian economy being devastated, with an outflow of foreign currency, with you know, possibly, you know, let's be honest what the U.S. plan is. Look, Mr. Michael McFaul, when he just left as ambassador, basically persona non grata, and was accused from the moment he arrived in Moscow as stirring up a color revolution plan. The plan is to turn the screws on so tightly on the average Russian citizen, worker and citizen, that he gets so sick of the government, he'll take any alternative, and then you displace the government the way you did in Georgia, Moldova, Yugoslavia, Kyrgyzstan, Lebanon, any number of other places.
My next question fits right in here, is will the imminent economic collapse of the Western world change the strategy and tactics of the U.S.?
You know, this is maybe the real gist of the question. There are so many truths we don't speak, but we harbor within ourselves. One of them, we know that the U.S. can trifle with any other country in the face of the earth, including China, militarily, and get away with it, and we all know it. There's one country in the world it has to be careful about because they have a nuclear arsenal comparable to ours. You want to be reductionist? I'll be reductionist. And they have a triad of delivery systems like the United States. And as a result, there's only one country in the world you really have to worry about. And if you neutralize that country, then heaven help us. And if you neutralize Russia as, you know, the world's largest exporter of natural gas, and as of 3 or 4 years ago, for a short period of time, they actually had outstripped Saudi Arabia as the largest exporter of oil. You know, but the hydrocarbon exporter of the world, one of the two major nuclear weapons powers, if you neutralize that, then you want to talk about world sole nuclear superpower, military superpower, boy, you're going to see it.
Russia being locked out of the European gas market. It seems here's winter's coming. What are the consequences for my concern is that with the gap between shutting off from Russia and the lag of getting energy in from other sources, that there's going to be a lot of cold public discontent, and that may be used to drive more pro-war interest toward Russia.
Yeah, that's been an issue. You know, we have to remember that the 2004 presidential campaign in Ukraine had three front runners, right? They were Viktor Yushchenko, Viktor Yanukovych, and Yulia Tymoshenko, all three, by the way, of whom had been prime ministers under the Kuchma government at various times. And we remember that as soon as Yanukovych wins, and let's be frank about how politics are run, I mean, sure, Russia exercised whatever economic and diplomatic and bribes and God knows what to affect the outcome of the 2010 election. But if you remember, Yulia Tymoshenko, the gas princess, as she's less than affectionately known in Ukraine, was immediately jailed by Yanukovych because of supposed secret oil deals with natural gas deals with Russia. So here you have, you know, the so-called Russian puppet is jailing somebody for, you know, dealing with Russia and that kind of thing. The U.S. has already indicated that it's prepared to engage in fracking, supplying fracked natural gas to Ukraine. We know that the vice president, some would argue the real gray eminence in the White House, Mr. Biden's son, our Hunter Biden, is now on the board of directors of the major oil energy company in Ukraine. We know that there was a meeting held in September of 2013 in Yalta, in the very same palace that Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin met in, with the two Clintons, with a billionaire oligarch, Viktor Pinchuk, with bunch of very interesting people, including Yanukovych, incidentally, right, where they were talking about something. And I suspect one of the topics they were talking about is oil and natural gas and so forth. So the U.S., I think, you may see something. I mean, I'm going out on a limb a bit. You may be something like the Berlin airlift, where the U.S. really comes in and bails out the Ukrainian people and brings in, you know, free gas and oil to get them through the winter or something like that. It wouldn't be beyond them to pull off some stunt like that.
Will they be able to blame Russia
for that? Of course they're going to blame Russia for that.
But I mean, will the people accept that?
You know, my feeling is the country is so bifurcated and divided amongst itself. Those are going to blame Russia for anything, and those who aren't.
Can you go into Putin's base of support? At one time, it was technocrats in the major cities. Can you explore that for us?
No, that's an extremely rich question. I only wish I could answer it, and I have to confess that I can't. But I can say this real quickly. Is that when he became president of the Russian Federation the first time in 2000, and by all accounts, was singled out for that position by his predecessor Boris Yeltsin, that at that time the major political party in both houses of the Russian Parliament, the Federated Council and the Duma, by a long shot was the Communist Party of the Russian Federation. And it appeared to be the mission of Mr. Putin to destroy that political party, and he seems to have succeeded. So that he's created United Russia, his own party, as the dominant political party in both houses of Congress, or both houses of Parliament, rather, and that it's very difficult to challenge him then politically. Then you have on the other end, the U.S. is keeping the so-called NGOs, the Color Revolution contingent in supply. And then, you've got any number of economic sectors. You still have billionaire oligarchs in Russia. You know, they haven't all fled. And when they start feeling the pinch, my guess is they'll throw Putin over. But, beyond that, I can't really even speculate.
Who claimed to be employed by Russia like 10 years ago, he said that the Russian gas reserves were enormous and they were trying to work out a plan such that the profits from the gas would end up being a aid to the Russian people. And because according to this person I talked to, the Russian gas reserves are absolutely enormous and almost to the point that aren't quite understood in the West. He said that as the oil runs out, Russia's gas is going to, there's going to become a point where their reserves are economically equal to all the rest of the world's energy and timber reserves combined in terms of total value. What do you think about, if Russia could maintain some kind of autonomy, that eventually they're still going to have a tremendous card to play in this way?
I think it's a matter of timing. If we're looking in a peaceful world that looks absolutely nothing like the current one that could make sense. Russia could have 10 times what it has in terms of natural gas. If it has no one to sell it to, it doesn't do it much good. And with the embargoes and with the exclusion of Russia from economic relations, you know, who are they going to sell this natural gas to? You know, blue gold is fine and good. And it is definitely the clean energy resource of the future. Everyone understands that. And they can compensate in large part by selling to China and hopefully to India and Japan and South Korea, who, by the way, those four countries are the next largest next to the United States, those four Asian countries. Yeah, EU is the second largest collective consumer of energy, but those four Asian countries I mentioned. So it's very important where they get their gas and oil from. And Russia could certainly compensate for that. But that suggests, again, a Eurasian turn or an Asian turn by Russia, which basically says, I want to quote Victoria Nuland, basically says the EU, right? Russia doesn't need the EU. EU needs Russia. But the US would prefer they not need Russia. So, you know, there you go.